WFSU-FM now presents a visit to the Village Square, a community forum on the most important issues of our day. Our program this evening, All Bollocked Up, America Plus the World, Trump and Brexit, is a conversation with Dr. Justin Guest, author of The New Minority, White Working Class Politics in an Age of Immigration and Inequality. This delayed broadcast was recorded at St. John's Episcopal Church in Tallahassee on January 24, 2017.
Good evening. My name is Bill Maddox. I'm on a member of the Board of Directors for the Village Square. And on behalf of the Village Square, I'd like to welcome you to All Bollocked Up, America and the World in the Age of Trump and Brexit. We're delighted that you are here, and we're delighted also that we are joined by a number of others who are listening in via WFSU radio. Tonight's program is the second in this year's Dinner at the Square series, Through the Looking Glass of Modern Politics, and our program tonight is made possible by the generous support of Theracue and Spain Law Firm, and so we want to especially thank them tonight. We'd also like to, as Christine mentioned, thank the catering by Seminole Dining, and especially Randy, Tracy, Cindy, and their team. They have been great to us this year, and we really appreciate them. Please join me in thanking them. A couple of reminders about ground rules, which many of you who've been to our programs over the years will find familiar. We will, of course, have our usual civility bells to ding just in case someone gets a little out of hand. There we go. So beware of that, and please don't make us use it. Secondly, as usual, we would discourage you from what we call team clapping. That's the practice of clapping when someone from your side says something that you agree with, or maybe giving a little groan when someone says something that you disagree with. We'd like to ask you to do neither of those things. We think that you'll actually leave having a better experience if you hold your opinions loosely for the next 90 minutes. We will tonight, however, be making one exception to this general no clapping rule, and that is for all of you who are like me, not sure that you have a team anymore. We will permit one hand clapping tonight at any point. We'd all like to hear the sound of one hand clapping. Okay, without further ado, it's my pleasure to introduce to you a woman who really needs no introduction. She's our facilitator for tonight's program. She is the woman who a dozen years before the rise of Donald Trump presciently saw the need for a way to promote civil discourse. Please join me in welcoming to the stage our very own executive director, Liz Joyner.
Thanks. So can you guys hear me okay?
Yes.
You can hear me okay. So I wanted to say a word about why I'm doing this evening, because for those of you who have been with us for a long time, you know I never do. I have a full decade of incredibly bossy and detailed instruction to facilitators, and I figured maybe it was time for me to see if that worked. And if you've been one of my facilitators, I see you out there. Don't use this evening as revenge, please. So really, to me, I believe very deeply that we're at a really important inflection point in American democracy, maybe in world order, in a way that I think that there's a fork in the road right now, and the way that we've been going down it is very worrisome to me. So this is really a heart issue for me, and we have a very heart guest for me. I looked really hard to find him, somebody who I thought would help us have this conversation tonight. So I guess one thing I wanted to say also is just that, in some ways, this isn't exactly the conversation I thought we'd be having right now, just like most people. And so, tempers are high, everybody's upset. And I guess I want to invite you guys to be a place where something new starts, where we take where we are now and move forward constructively. So to that extent, I hope that we can sort of be a family for the evening. Without further ado, Justin Guest is an assistant professor of public policy at George Mason University, Sklar School, did I say that correctly? Schar School, of Policy and Government. His teaching and research interests include comparative politics, minority political behavior, and immigration policy. He focused first on Muslim populations immigrating into Western democracies in Europe before turning his attention to white working class people in Britain and America. His books include Apart, Alienated and Engaged Muslims in the West, and The New Minority, White Working Class Politics in the Age of Immigration and Inequality. We have that tonight. You'll have about 5 minutes to get a signed copy before Justin has to move on to Florida State University. His analysis appeared in the Boston Globe, The Guardian, The Houston Chronicle, The Hill, The Los Angeles Times, Reuters. It goes on and on. The Times, The Washington Post. New publications are basically being added by the minute because Dr. Guest has something that's really important to share with us tonight. Justin. So it's really different from here, just saying. That's not a little bit funny. All right, so Justin, contextualize the slideshow that people have been looking at for the evening.
Yeah, you know, that's such a great question. Let me just start, Liz, by thanking you and by thanking the Village Square and by thanking you all and the various donors and contributors. In the course of being invited here, and I'm very honored and flattered to be invited, I've learned a lot about this organization, and you know, it makes me sad that there aren't more organizations like this one around our country, in big cities, in small towns, in the Rust Belt, in the Desert West. It's this kind of social fabric, the tightening of that social fabric and the threads, that I see really loosening up right now at a time when we really need it the most. And you know, that's really the remedy for the polarization and the atomization that we are up against, I think, in American society. And so, you know, the more you guys can do to support organizations like this, the merrier, and I'm certainly happy to do my part as well. So thank you for being here, and thank you very much again for inviting me, Liz. So to answer your question, we could talk for hours, honestly, about, you know, they say pictures are worth 1,000 words. And these sure are. The images that you're looking at right now are from Youngstown, Ohio. But another half of these images are from Barking and Dagenham, which is the east of the East End of London. It's called East London. We're rotating fast enough that I can't really annotate it for you properly. But these are images from a city that was once a mecca for the manufacturing era. Youngstown, Ohio was basically a Silicon Valley of the manufacturing age. People from everywhere, every corner of the earth came to Youngstown because it had these factories pumping and percolating soot into the air. And Youngstowners, for their part, as long as you saw that black smoke coming out of those factories, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, working 3 shifts, you knew times were good. In the summer, and really any time of the year, but especially in the summer, the air would glisten from the shine of graphite in the air. And it would settle onto people's windshields and their patios, and they'd wipe it and they'd look at each other and say, pay dirt, pay dirt. Because times were good. You got a good job that was a middle-class salary, 9 to 5, it was stable, you weren't going to lose it, and if you did lose it, you knew you could get another one the next day. And it was enough to support a family, often without having your spouse work as well. And you know, these factories were like part of that community fabric. They were sort of like the Village Square for those days, right? Because they provided support for newsletters and picnics and events like this where you gathered people together. And they allowed for a community to feel more organized and together. And one day, on September 19th, 1977, it's 40 years ago, the first factory in Youngstown, Ohio, where they built steel, shut. All of a sudden, on a Monday, it was called Black Monday. And when it shut, without any notice, there were no jobs to get the next day, as used to be the case, because it started a series of closures, one after the next, until every major steel mill in that city basically shut down within 5 years. 55,000 jobs gone in a 5-year period. I mean, that's not just a collapse, that's a catastrophe. And a city, you know, that had 170,000 people there, 55,000 jobs, is enormous. And there was a string of events that took place after that in the intimate lives of people. Domestic abuse rates went up. Divorces started to skyrocket. Suicides rose very steadily. And eventually, Youngstown, Ohio, this now dilapidated steel town, became the murder capital of the United States of America. And it shows you what happens when that civic fabric comes apart, right?
You're talking about jobs that were good, solid, middle-class jobs, where you could have the job, you'd stay with the company for your life, you'd raise your children, you'd retire.
Exactly right.
Whole different thing.
And it's also that with those jobs also went your social life, right? It went your economic means of engaging with your community, right? Whether you're going to the barber or whether you're going to the market. And it also went your political life, because you didn't have money anymore, and so suddenly you felt like you didn't matter as much, or you weren't part of a union anymore, and therefore you didn't have the platform to make claims of the political system from that union. So it was really like a house of cards. It just came straight down. And these are dilapidated factories, what you see right there. One of them is a tire factory. This is one of the last, you talk about civic life in Youngstown, where you see the neon lights in a cafe. That's the Golden Dawn pub. And there it is again. The Golden Dawn is maybe the most treasured institution in Youngstown, because it's one of the last few hangouts for working class people in Youngstown. The rest of them have all closed up because they can't get the business. And so these kinds of pubs were those hubs of community life for so many people, and sure enough, you know, they're not there anymore.
So you call them post-traumatic cities.
I call them post-traumatic cities. They have endured a trauma, an apocalypse in many ways.
And one of the observations that you made in the book that really really has importance to me is that you observe that at a national level, what we see is the politics that come out of post-traumatic cities without understanding what's going on in post-traumatic cities, that it's hard to contextualize unless you know what's happening.
Yeah, I think these things are so easy to judge from afar, you know, and context matters so much. But more than just judgment, I think that we start to lose scope of the humanity at the center of these crises. And, you know, when we talk about a city collapsing in this apocalyptic way like Youngstown has, and by the way, like many other post-traumatic cities have around the United States, not just the Rust Belt either. You know, there are cotton towns in the South, you know, rubber towns elsewhere in the North, a lot of factory cities, factory towns. When you have one of these great collapses and great catastrophes, there are thousands of mini catastrophes happening in the living rooms of the homes that you just drive right on by or see when you're flying over them. And I think that it's important that we humanize these crises in order to really understand what's going on in people's lives. You know, we talk about 1977, Liz. For many people, that was when the Great Recession started. It wasn't 2007. For folks in the Rust Belt, who really were the swing voters in this election that everyone talks about, their crisis, their economic crisis, has been going on for the last 40 years. And, you know, so when we talk about, oh, the global recession, it was a big deal. Yeah, it was a big deal. But that was when all of us kind of started to feel the hurt, the pinch, that they feel like they have been feeling ever since the 1970s.
And in some ways, some of us are just feeling the pinch now, right? And so, but for...
Politically.
But for them, right, politically, for the people in these communities, you're talking 40 years.
40 years.
That's epic.
Yeah, yeah. Without any signs of hope.
Or without sort of interaction that, you know, people sort of aren't going there, they're not understanding, they're not immersing themselves in the situations as existed. I pulled a quote from a college student's essay that I read online that said, "These people are scraping the bottom of the barrel, and they seemingly have nothing to benefit from maintaining the system of order that keeps them at the bottom." I mean, I wouldn't.
I mean, I think that one of the most detrimental parts, you know, when we think about losing the civic fabric and the social fabric, is that the core of a society are the people who live there. And Youngstown, Ohio, as in continuing with this particular example that I'm so familiar with, we talked about being 170,000 people strong at its peak, but today it has 65,000 people. They've lost two-thirds of their population, right? It is a shell of what it used to be. And it's not just because the mills shut, the factories closed, and houses have been burnt down. We can talk about houses being burnt down later. But, you know, what really was the crisis is that Youngstown itself left. You know, people left Youngstown. And demographically, that's devastating, but socially, it's death.
Yeah, and actually, you know, here in town, we work really hard to keep young, promising people here. You can't in Youngstown, right? And in cities like that.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, Tallahassee has a business that will never go under, and that's the state government. And with all due respect to the folks here, you know, congratulations, you have a very stable job. The university is also in decent shape, you know, if you're at a university. But, you know, Youngstown was a product of its era. And I think for a while, people thought that the steel mills were in better shape than the state government of Ohio. And for a while, it definitely was, you know, pay dirt.
So one of the reactions I had in reading the book is that just the moving back and forth from East London to Youngstown, is it a kind of validation that there's something much bigger going on that we have to be looking at? That obviously these are communities that are disconnected from each other, and the same, very similar things are happening in both.
You know, in the United States, we have a propensity to think that when something happens here, it's the first time it's ever happened, it's the biggest time it's ever happened, it's never been like this before, it's huge, it's, you know, it's amazing. I'm channeling someone you know. And sometimes that's true, you know, but sometimes it isn't. And in this case, in many ways, we were the last ones to come to this populist party. Europe has been going through transformations in its politics over the last 20 years that has seen the rise of what people there call the radical right or the far right. And these are basically politicians that espouse largely, more or less, what you're hearing from Donald Trump and his administration. It's protectionist in its economic views, and it's nativist in its social views, and or nationalist, depending on how you think of it. And these parties have been popping up around Europe for a very long time, as I mentioned, several decades. Just to give you some examples, the most prominent one would be the Front National, the National Front in France, but maybe you've also heard of the People's Party in Switzerland or in Austria. The People's Party in Austria nearly won a majority last year. Then you have the Freedom Party with Geert Wilders, who is the head of it in the Netherlands, the Swedish Democrats, and now you have new parties emerging in Germany, Alternative for Germany, where it was very much a faux pas to have a far-right party after its legacy of Nazism. It was frowned upon, but now it's emerging. And in the United Kingdom, where they have the United Kingdom Independence Party. And you may have heard of UKIP, as they're known, because they were basically the ringleaders for Brexit, the decision to leave the European Union. And, you know, really, the Britain and the United States were very late to this party. And the reason why, and I'm gonna go all political science on you for a second, but I think it's important to show how rules matter. The way their election rules worked were different than ours here in the United States. In the United States, we have a first-past-the-post system, right? Single-member districts. You have a single-member districts, and the person who has the most votes wins and takes all, right? In continental Europe, they have different rules that are proportionately based. So if you have a party in a place like Austria and it gets 26% of the vote nationally, they get 26% of the seats in the legislature. So what that means is that far right, far left fringe parties have a much better chance of winning, because if you support one of those alternative parties, your vote counts as much as anyone else's. So you might as well vote for them. But in the United States, if you had a far right, far left party, you wouldn't vote for a third or fourth party in the United States, because you know that your vote's going to be wasted.
So this was like sort of part of the internal distress in both the Republican and Democratic Party of late.
Is because all of those alternatives have to be integrated into our parties, right? And so for this reason, it delayed our arrival to this far right fiesta going on the continent, right? And so Britain came in, and now finally we came in, but we, the United States, did something different because we leapfrogged them all. Now we are the first country, really, in the West, that has a far right politician as the head of state. None of them have won over the government in any of these other countries yet. Now that may change, and some people predict that in France it could change, but it's still looking doubtful according to polls. But as we know, polls are only so useful, as I'm sure you've concluded.
We do know that, which is a great segue into, so we were all surprised, most everybody was surprised by the results of this election, not Justin. Writing well before the election, you said basically 5 years ago you were looking at this. The white working class makes up 53% of the electorate in Michigan, 55% in Pennsylvania, 58% in Wisconsin, 62% in Ohio, 66% in Indiana, and nearly 70% in West Virginia. He kind of called all those states. This subset of the American electorate is the key determinant of electoral outcomes. Duh. But alas, one that we have misunderstood and undermobilized. So this was knowable.
Did I write all that?
You did. Well done. This was knowable, but so many of us were flummoxed by the results. So I guess I have this basic theory in my life, and it's proven to be true over and over again. And the theory is this. If you really understand what a human's circumstances are, what they know, what they don't know, what's around them, if you can really sort of walk a mile, they make sense. So presumably we didn't understand this group of people. So having spent so much time in these two communities, what are we missing that we need to understand how they make sense?
So I think there's two things we need to know, and they're at different levels. So forgive me because I'm thinking, because this is all unscripted, so I don't know what questions are coming.
I tried to get him to give me some questions. He didn't.
No.
He likes it this way.
I like it this way. It's much more interesting. So when I pause, it's because I'm actually thinking. So there's two things there's obviously a lot of complexity here, but the two headlines are, one is at the political electoral level, and then the second is at the human level. The sociological level. So at the political electoral level, for a long time, Rust Belt white working class people were viewed as the inscrutable swing voter. Republicans 1 year, Democrats the next year, and parties understood these voters to be these fearless independents, right? It's like, you know, you never know what they're going to go for this year or next year, and they kind of go from party to party, and, you know, we have to win them over, but we're not quite sure how. And the reason why we're not quite sure how is because the parties had issues with white working class people. Republicans, for their part, were okay with the nativism and the nationalism among white working class people, but they weren't okay with the protectionist economics. Democrats were cool with the protectionist economics, but they weren't okay with that nativism and nationalism, because it complicates their party coalitions, right? So they refused to directly engage with white working class people, and so they swayed. But the reason that they swayed was not because they were fiercely independent. It was because they couldn't find a single party that actually cared about them. They couldn't find a party that wanted to be and actually was representing their voice. So when they moved to Barack Obama, and many white working class people in the Rust Belt did vote for President Obama in 2008 and in 2012, It was because they were fed up with the Bush administration, who they supported and made promises, and they weren't kept. And when they supported Donald Trump after supporting Barack Obama, and Youngstown, Ohio, by the way, Mahoning County, had a 20-point swing, okay, from 4 years to, across 4 years. When they did that, it was because they didn't think that Barack Obama's recovery was in their interests, and they didn't feel like he represented their voice either. And finally, you have Donald Trump, improbably, this Manhattan real estate mogul millionaire with gold-plated everything, and his beauty queen wife, somehow could be their voice. It's because he was the only person who wanted to be their voice. He was the only person that actually sought their vote directly, purposefully, deliberately, and meaningfully from their perspective. So it didn't matter if he wasn't white working class himself. He was the first politician in generations to actually care.
The first time for 40 years somebody's even paid attention, even heard.
And made them feel powerful again, right? So when Donald Trump says, make America great again, right? And we can talk about that slogan more if you want to later, so not note that down. But it was about making white working class people in many cases feel great again, The second phenomenon that I want to underscore at the human level, at the sociological level, is that, and here we're going to get into race, because I'm sure we'll eventually talk about race, so we might as well, hey, let's just jump right into the deep end. Is that...
That's what we do here.
That's good. So, for many white working class people, they have felt marginalized in many cases because of their race. They believe that they are now on the back end of the civil rights movement. They think that they are the civil rights case, that they are subject to outnumbering, that they are subject to feeling external from government and power, and that they are being discriminated against because they are white and because they are poor. Okay? Don't kill the messenger in case this unnerves you. But it's important that you hear it, because I think many of you probably have never heard this before, and that's why it sounds so crazy. But it's also the reason why I called my book The New Minority. My subjects feel like minorities in countries they used to define. And so what's so contentious about this, the race, the element of race in this election and the politics thereafter, is that for many people who did not support Donald Trump, the idea that white people are somehow disadvantaged after the legacy of systematic oppression, structural disadvantage that is dangling around our country's necks at all times, is impossible to even conceive in that context. But if you were to speak with my subjects and you say to them, white working class people, don't you get it? You benefit from those invisible wages of whiteness, the white privilege that just comes because of your skin tone in this country. There are benefits to that. You're paid more in your jobs. You are taken more seriously. You are not subject to housing discrimination or employer discrimination or casual discrimination, social discrimination. My subjects would say back, look at my life. I am one unexpected medical bill, one car accident from that trailer park, from not being able to feed my kids. What privilege are you talking about? What are these wages of whiteness that you're talking about? What wages have I been paid in my life? And so whether we find what they say to be preposterous, it is human and it is real for them. And that greater context of oppression and slavery and legacies of structural disadvantage are irrelevant to their living room.
One of the things that surprised me in reading your book that I realized I think was just an assumption that I made. So, when we talk all the time about how social media, the way that we communicate with each other, has sort of put us in our own little silos and really created kind of a sense of it's vaporizing the civic glue. That's why this organization exists, to have some civic glue. I think I thought of that as a big city problem. I think that my bias was that you've got these communities who are having these challenges, but they have each other. That the civic glue is strong there. But what you describe is that you've got communities that church attendance is way down, marriage is falling apart. That there isn't any, and in fact, you really described sort of a sense of kind of. Of distrust that really infiltrated these communities. Yeah. Talk more about that.
Yeah, you know, human beings, as much as we may not want to acknowledge it in all of our modernity right now, we need some sort of moral order in our life. And for some of us, that comes from the Bible. From some of us, that comes from capitalism or Adam Smith. For some of us, that comes from, you know, an upbringing that of a particular way that instills certain moral order. For some of us, it comes from science, something that helps us make sense of the world and our place in it. And for many in the Rust Belt in particular, and other parts of the United States, where you had factory towns, that mill provided you with that moral order. The city was based around the rhythms and the cadences of the job, such that everyone was one together. Kind of like when you're in school, everyone hears those same bells, and they know when lunch is, and they know when recess is, and they know when school's over. And those factories provided you with structure, right? And not only did they provide you a structure in the workplace and the things associated with it, but they also created the need, because they were so stable, they created a market for political organization to fill political vacuums, right? So unions were so important because not only were they the source of political life, but they were also the source of social life. Right? You met each other at union events, you met each other through the union, you're part of something bigger than yourself. And so in the book, as you recall, I describe in many cases in the Rust Belt what I call as a union hangover.
Yeah.
Because when the unions went away, the unions were the muscle for white working class people. They were their civic organizations, they were their village square. And even differently from the Village Square, they lobbied. They were partisan, right? And when that went away, white working class people, what about their personal muscles? They didn't have those personal muscles because they had atrophied so long while relying upon the unions to do the work for them. Now, you could argue, you could counter-argue that, well, unions actually politicized this population, whereas perhaps before they weren't politicized. I agree. I think that's a fair point. But it's the point is that it's not just about being politicized in terms of making a difference in your democracy. You have to show up. You have to know how to lead. You have to know how to organize. And the unions basically were outsourced to doing that, such that when they disappeared, so much of that political capital went with them.
So you've got one industry that's big and huge, and it goes away, and everything goes with it, essentially.
And everything.
All the way that you organize your life. I mean, this community could sustain something like that because they're different things, but Youngstown and other industrial communities, it just vaporizes.
That's right. And there are sources today, in the absence of places where, you know, you may have had unions or something similar, where atomization is taking place as well. You know, there's a wonderful book by a colleague of mine from MIT named Sherry Turkle called Alone Together. And it's about the way the internet isolates us, right? And it is very possible that the more things become intermediated between us through television, internet, and other forms of, you know, wireless communication that allows us to sort of occupy this, you know, our own little bubble and silos, that we became disconnected from each other in those important ways. And so you don't have to have a factory collapse to have that civic life collapse. It's collapsing in a lot of ways around us.
I mean, everywhere. And I mean, in some ways it's gonna take us a little while. I think we're sort of just catching on. Uh-oh, this is what this causes. But I think one of my personal frustrations is just that it feels like that's one of those problems that Like, I don't know, Dorothy could always go back to Kansas when she clicked her heels. I recognize that there's economic struggles there, but I wonder why the glue isn't getting tighter, you know? Because it feels like it would empower people and help things move and change, but it just feels like it isn't.
Well, I think what we're
like
seeing...
Like church attendance. I mean, that would be an example, is that you got to know a Catholic priest there. Mm-hmm. And so, like, I want people to be meeting each other at church and talking to each other.
So, you know, there is a debate in the world of social science around, you know, whether the internet can bring people together in ways that churches used to. And a former colleague of mine when I was at Harvard, Robert Putnam, wrote a book called Bowling Alone, which is one of the most famous books of political science. And a lot of political scientists, by the way, think he's completely wrong, okay? About a variety of things. But one of the things that I think was most controversial was that Bob Putnam is quite conservative when it comes to the internet. At least he certainly was. And he didn't believe that meetups, chat rooms, organizing online could replace bowling tournaments, could replace those picnics that I talked about, newsletters, and community organizations where you have to show up. And this was actually repeated by Malcolm Gladwell in a piece he wrote called The Revolution Will Not Be Tweeted, where he criticized Twitter and various other social media as forms of civil rights builders and civic engagement builders because they were so passive. All you had to do is type, sometimes anonymously, something, but you didn't actually have to show up. You didn't have to sacrifice something. You didn't have to experience something. But I think, and maybe this is just because I'm a millennial, what we're starting to see is the ways that these new tools are very powerful. And you know, you look at the last Saturday, right? That was an effort around the country, begun online, remained online until everybody showed up. You look at the revolution in Egypt, which was largely done by, actually, Twitter. You know, this was basically a Twitter-based revolution, and because the government of Egypt could not control Twitter, they couldn't suppress opinion. So now, fast forward to today, what the internet is doing, though, simultaneously, is because it reinforces our preferences by accommodating them, meaning the ads that you see are tailored for what you want to read about because you've read about it before. You know, the content that is suggested to you if you're on Facebook or another social media platform is generated by an algorithm that recognizes your earlier preferences as a good predictor of your future preferences. What this is creating is a siloization of the United States and many other societies because we're not being exposed to things that don't conform to our preferences. So what's happening here tonight, where you have Democrats and Republicans, liberals and conservatives, elderly and young, white and black, does not happen on the internet very much. Because, generally speaking, your demographic profile is reinforced into your internet profile. And so it leads all of us to exist in these echo chambers. So while that may unite us in some small way, it is divorcing us and segregating us and sorting us from our fellow citizens.
Yeah, and we're spending less time with this kind of group in our own communities and our own lives.
And hearing things that we disagree with.
Right.
Hearing things that we may not like or haven't heard before.
Right. And my personal thing is sort of, you know, I mean, that's what American democracy is about, is we're structured so that we have to listen to the other side of an issue because that's the only way we can solve the problem. And if we're in fact specifically avoiding it, right?
You're in trouble.
Yeah, yeah.
And people don't talk after that.
Right. So tell us about James Traficant in Youngstown. And I think this is metaphoric because to most of us that's sort of synonymous with, it's a name synonymous with corruption, right?
Yeah.
But not in Youngstown.
Well, I think...
I mean, well, they know.
I think they know he's corrupt. I think you know he was corrupt. So James Traficant, Jim Traficant, and to his friend Jimbo, Jimmy, was the congressman for Youngstown, Ohio from 1982 until 2000. 18 years, 9 terms in the U.S. Congress, in the House of Representatives. Before that, he was the county sheriff, if I'm not mistaken. And he has this legendary status in Youngstown, Ohio, amongst its white working class community in particular. And the reason why I speak about him, or write about him extensively in the book, and the reason why Liz is bringing him up, is because he is effectively a predecessor for Donald Trump. I'll explain. When Traficant was sheriff, he accepted bribes from the local Pittsburgh-based mafia and the Cleveland-based mafia. He played both sides. And he was prosecuted by the FBI. Pause for a second. When you're prosecuted by the Department of Justice, they don't do it unless it's a slam dunk. Okay, they don't waste their time with cases they may lose. The feds are usually 100% sure. They prosecuted him. He represented himself in federal court and fended off the feds and got away with it, from all impressions related. And from that moment, Jim Traficant basically got legendary status, because already Youngstown was a frustrated place in the 1980s. And when he fended off the feds by himself, just this lone, soldier in the federal court system, it was like a big middle finger up to Washington, D.C.
It's like a Clint Eastwood movie, right?
Go to hell.
Yeah.
Right? And people loved it.
And you can see why it would feel that way.
Right, because they felt like they, at that point already, that things weren't going well for them and that they had been abandoned. And Jimmy Traficant claimed to be their voice in Washington. And when I say their voice, I mean their voice. He funneled word from the street, conspiracy theories, all kinds of random stuff, to the House of the Representatives floor, to the chamber. And he would go on these often midnight tirades. Okay, and he wore these just garish bell-bottom suits, the big 70s collar lapels, and he had this pompadour on his head, which most people were certain was a toupee, but I think it was actually his hair. In any case, it was strange enough that people weren't sure it was real, because they weren't sure he was real. And he would preface all of his speeches and often end them by saying, "Beam me up, Mr. Speaker." Oftentimes, the speaker wasn't even there. And he would just rant about things that his colleagues in the House were like, "This guy's crazy." But he was saying things that were echoing from the streets of Youngstown, Ohio.
We haven't been paying attention for a long time.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, when it's on C-SPAN 3 at midnight, you may be doing other things like sleeping, But so Jim Traficant served as the congressman for that district, for the Mahoning County in Ohio, for 18 years. Only until 2000, when he basically had to leave office because he was imprisoned on corruption charges. They finally got him, further accepting bribes, 10 counts of bribery and corruption and racketeering. Finally put him into prison. They finally won. And he was replaced by a former aide of his, Tim Ryan, who is still the congressman from Youngstown, Ohio. And Jim Traficant, even in prison, was beloved. He ran for office from prison, to get his seat back. And he lost. He's not that much of a legend. But he still got 15-17% of the vote, for a guy that's in prison, right? And he wasn't able to get his seat back from his former aide. And recently, actually, about 3 years ago, died in a pretty awful tractor accident. But he is revered in Youngstown as that voice of the white working class person. And in many ways, he wasn't even working class himself. He had a master's degree. It didn't matter, because Jimbo was their guy.
And he heard them. And really, we're talking about communities that have gotten used to very systemic dysfunction, right? So, depending on how Maslow's hierarchy of needs, some of us are up there at the top about belonging and being nice to each other. We're talking about communities that are down at the level of survival. And so they're talking about, they're having a different conversation. They're in a different place than we
That's
are.
That's right. And just so you know, if you go to the Royal Oak Pub in the east of Youngstown, there is a portrait of Jim Traficant, a sketch, really.
No, I didn't know that. That's great.
With a crown of thorns around his head. We are in church, aren't we? All right.
Well, and you know, East London, you're talking about, so there was a gathering. The pubs are going away, right? There was like a 1729 pub.
They're gone. They're endangered species.
Right.
Yeah, they're prone to closing because they just don't have the business left. Not just because their community is poorer, but also because their community is emigrating. They're migrating out of these cities.
And then immigrants are coming in, and the neighborhood food stores are changing to food of North Africa.
Sub-Saharan Africa or South Asia.
And so it's just very substantively different. Really, East London has had much more international immigration, obviously, than we have and that our world.
And that's an interesting point, because the two cases, the real thing that makes them different is their location in the scope of their countries, right? So Youngstown, being a sort of, you know, a small city in the United States Rust Belt, about an hour south of Cleveland, Ohio, it's not feeding off of Cleveland. It was its own city. And so when people left, there was no one coming back in. They just left. So you had that huge population change. And it was a city that was 90% white. And when I say white, I mean like the amalgam of white. So that could include Lebanese or Hungarian or Italian or Irish or Jews. That was 90% white. Today it is 50-50. 50% black, 50% white, with some biracial folks in there. And it's not that black people didn't leave Youngstown or started coming into Youngstown. It's just that they didn't leave as fast as the white folks did. In East London, the demographic change that happened was that white working class people with means left. Those who owned their homes sold them and got out. But it was still on the fringe of one of the most prosperous global cities in the entire world, London. And so immigrants who were moving to the United Kingdom saw East London as this affordable place to live. And the homes that were being sold by white working class people were to people from sub-Saharan Africa, South Asia, Eastern Europe, like Lithuania or the other Baltic states. And so their communities were changing, not from a demographic change white to black because of population displacement, but actually because immigrants were coming in and replacing white working class people.
And the sense in the community is, like Youngstown, that the social capital, the civic glue, didn't hold. So, you know, you have people talking about how, you know, somebody would die in the neighborhood before and everybody would be over. Well, it just doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah. That's exactly right.
And to me, this is just so basically human. We're talking about human beings who want to live in communities, and they feel there's enemy instead of community.
And I think the hard part for East London, but also for Youngstown, is that there isn't a greater sense of we that holds folks together. So a bunch of immigrants came into your neighborhood. When someone dies, shouldn't they know about it too? Shouldn't you knock on their door when you're making an appeal for your church? There's a sense of, oh, they're not like us, right? White working class people in Youngstown don't want to go to the east side or the south side of Youngstown because that's a black neighborhood. It's like, well, they're not really like us, or they're not really going to go along with what we care about. Well, why the heck not, right? Yeah. And so you have this atomization taking place with demographic change, because it's viewed as change that is something you can't get over, right? As if like we're supposed to live our lives without evolving with our communities.
Yeah, and I mean, isn't that sort of the human condition, that we sort of like, if we could engineer a Martian invasion, which I'm not recommending, but wouldn't everything shift? Like, all of a sudden we see each other as the humans who need to protect. And so in some ways that's just sort of how humans roll.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. East London has always been a sort of immigrant area of London because it was the working class part. It was lower income, it was rougher, it was more congested. And the first immigrants to come to East London were French Huguenots. So they were Protestants, just like the rest of Britain, but they were French, right? So, oh, holy Jesus, here come, you know, frogs, right? And so everybody freaked out. Well, then a generation later came the Irish, who were fleeing famine and other things in Ireland, and they came into the East End. Well, all of a sudden people forgot about the fact that these were French people, and they recognized them as fellow Protestants, but they saw the Irish came in, and they said, oh God, Catholics. Fast forward a little bit later, and Eastern European Jews were coming in to escape the pogroms that were killing and oppressing them. Well, now all of a sudden, forget the fact that they're Catholics, they're still Christians, they're Jews coming into our neighborhood. And of course, as fate would have it, the next big group of people to come into East London were Muslims, right? And so all of a sudden, Jews start to look pretty British to people, you know? Not only were they largely European and had white skin, you know, spoke the language more or less, they also, you know, they weren't brown, right? Muslims were coming in from Bangladesh. This is a very different group of people coming in. And P.S., that they are the subject of my first book. This is actually how I got into this. It's funny because I'm an immigration scholar. My work covers immigration and demographic change. And so, you know, I learned about white working class people and the issues that were arising here from the perspective of Muslims initially, who were that last group into East London.
So we're going to take a couple questions and then come back to the discussion. So if you guys can maybe go out in the audience. And also, if you're shy about asking questions, we have question forms on the table, but we'd love to hear it from your lips if you're not shy. And actually, I have a prop for you while you answer this next question. So to me, one of the really important parts...
Is there lunch inside?
No, there is not. Okay. Sorry. Rosie was on a diet, apparently, when she stuffed the lunchbox.
Rosie didn't have a connection with Seminole Catering. Thanks, guys.
That's right. And thank you for that plug. So to me, this is one of the key things in understanding this dynamic, is that not just to understand the deprivation and the loss that this community feels in absolute terms, but in terms of who they were then and who they are now. And this is really true, I want you to answer the question more for Americans, but this is really true in both places, that the Brits and the Americans, these were the people who were the center of our society.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So since we were just briefly mentioning Muslims, one of the key findings from my first book, because at the time, and even still today, lamentably, everyone's wondering, why do Muslims radicalize? Why do they, you know, start to rebel against their own societies? And this was one of the fundamental motivating questions of my work. I then took that same question to ask about white working class people. Why are they radicalizing? Why are they turning against their societies? Maybe not violently in the way that we see in headlines with regard to Islamic communities, but nevertheless rebelling. And for Muslims, the answer was, there was a sense of deprivation, the word that Liz used here. And when I say deprivation, I mean there's a kind of ideal about the way the world ought to be, and then there's your perception about the way your world is. And the discrepancy matters. So if you have a big discrepancy between the way the world ought to be and the way the world is, I found out that you are more likely to be radicalized. And so I said to myself, well, surely that's going to be true for white people. We're all human. It should be the same. But I actually found that it was slightly tweaked. What I found in the field with white working class folks is that they were far more likely to support far-right parties and candidates, not when there is a big discrepancy between the way the world is and the way the world ought to be, but rather when there is a big discrepancy between the way the world is and the way the world was. And so the nature of white working class people's deprivation is nostalgic. They used to be on top economically, socially, politically, and they're not on top anymore.
I mean, they were the heart of our country. That's who we thought of when we thought of America, right?
Think of them as the backbone, the industrial backbone, the heart and soul, right? And there is this sense that they really were, and it was validated with political power, with social dominance, you know, with decent paying jobs, politicians who cared about them. And, you know, for a steady period of time, they feel like that's no longer the case. And I guess this is a perfect moment to come back to make America great again, okay? Because that slogan, if that slogan just was make America great, someone else would be president of the United States right now. But because it was make America great again, what does that again say? It says it used to be really great, and today it ain't so great anymore. And that is what fundamentally resonated with Donald Trump's white working class supporters, is that they look back into the past and see greatness. And they haven't tasted that in a very long time. And I will add that their perceptions of the past are rather uncomplicated. They are rather simplistic. They are uncomplicated by the legacies of oppression that we talked about, right? They're uncomplicated by the grinding nature of manufacturing work, the injunctions against working class unions. They're uncomplicated by all those complexities and the social ills that came from America's history that we have largely overcome with a variety of social movements since the 1960s. But for white working class people who are used to hearing oral histories like the one that I shared with you, the very first question Liz asked about the photography, when they've been hearing these same stories about the glory of the mid-20th century in their cities and towns and in their families, it sure sounded pretty good back then.
You wrote, the average white resident could not conceive of progress coming from the future. I mean, that's just, that the, says the, everything, right?
The only way that my subjects saw a post-traumatic future was by re-establishing the pre-traumatic past.
Yeah.
And the difficult part here for all of us, I think, but also for the President of the United States right now, is that that past isn't coming back. It's not coming back. You're not going to recreate it. And you might make America great again, but you're not going to make it great in the way it used to be great, because too much has changed. And I'm not just talking about socially. I'm also talking about economically. There is no way to revitalize the factories and mills of Youngstown, Ohio. No company will back it. So unless we're going to nationalize industries, which we know is not going to happen, then there is no way to do this fundamentally in a socially or economic way.
And there was a lot of interest in fracking coming in. And so you can imagine if you're in Youngstown, if we're having a debate about the environmental impacts of fracking, you don't care, right?
You don't care.
You want
the industry
in. Because
fracking is like that big stroke.
Right.
Right? Fracking is like, you know, that's like the descendant of the new industry.
And that's the way they see their future being rescued, is through some big company
coming
in.
One big swoop. They can't see it as something that you build organically. Yeah. As a community, it can only be the return of that signature industry. Yeah.
You've been listening to a delayed broadcast of the To the Village Square Community Forum of January 24th, 2017. Our program this evening, All Bollocked Up, America Plus the World, Trump and Brexit, is a conversation with Dr. Justin Guest, author of The New Minority, White Working Class Politics in an Age of Immigration and Inequality. This delayed broadcast was recorded at St. John's Episcopal Church in Tallahassee. Join us again next time for another visit to the Village Square on WFSU-FM.